and ciclavia.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.
Well, good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyer's Coach Show. I'm Jim Lafferty along with my friend and co-host Maria Hall. Hi, Maria. How you doing?
Hi, Jim. I'm doing good.
I know we've got a good show for our listeners today. Let them know what's
in store. Yes. Well, I'm super excited. Our first segment is going to be about the intersection of immigration and housing rights. Uh-huh. So it brings together all of my favorite activists, legal advocates. And then in our second half hour, we'll be talking with Marjorie Cohen, constitutional law scholar, about redistricting and voting rights.
Yeah, and what is likely to be a very important Supreme Court decision coming down the pike. All right. Well, we've got a lot to cover. Let's get right into it. Introduce our first topic, if you would, please.
All right. Well, thank you. Yes. Well, as we've seen, immigration remains in the headlines. And it's been eye-opening to me to see how many people don't realize that immigrants, even undocumented immigrants in the United States, have legal rights. People don't seem to understand that, at least for today. Everyone has the right to bring a lawsuit against their employer for unpaid wages, for example, whether or not you have papers. And more pertinent to today's topic, California is one of the states that has special protections for undocumented immigrants from discrimination and harassment by their landlords. And, you know, we've done many Lawyers Guild show segments on immigration, and we've done many on housing rights and tenants' rights. But I don't think we've ever before had a show like this about the intersection between immigration and housing issues.
No, I don't believe so. And it's become critically important.
Exactly. And even though lawyers become siloed, people out there are not siloed. They have all kinds of legal issues. So we have to get up to speed on this. So that's why I'm especially happy to introduce our three guests today in alphabetical order. Housing attorney Alexandra Hong, who has practiced eviction defense for the past 8 years. Wow, it goes so fast. And has most recently been supporting veterans in their housing struggles. And then we also have Madeline Howard, from senior attorney with Western Center on Law and Poverty, out up there in the Bay Area, who does housing justice work across California. And then we also have the fabulous Edna Monroy, the Tenants Rights Director from SAGE, aka Strategic Actions for a Just Economy, who is located right here in LA. Alexandra, Madeline, and Edna, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you, Jim.
Oh, hi, folks. Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
So important what you're doing.
Yeah, we've got the dream team here. So Madeline, why don't we start it off with you? California has some very special protections for tenants who are immigrants, protections that aren't offered by every state. I'm thinking of the Immigrant Tenant Protection Act. Tell us about the law, how long it's been enacted, and who exactly it protects.
Yeah, thank you, Maria, and thanks for having us on today. This topic is so important. It's been so scary and terrible with the raids, and it's adding this extra layer of fear now when we're hearing about landlords receiving these demands for information from the federal government. And it's just a really terrifying time and so important for people to feel safe in their homes. And yeah, I'm really thankful that we have this law in California that protects immigrants to some extent. And so it is called the Immigrant Tenant Protection Act. And this was actually enacted back in 2017. So the first time when Trump was elected, I hate saying that sentence, we were hearing from our legal aid partners and organizing partners about harassment against immigrants. It was really concerning that people just really didn't have rights. So back in 2016, my organization, Western Center on Law and Poverty, partnered with others, including California Rural Legal Assistance. California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation to sponsor this bill. So it's been the law for a long time now, but this is an important time to sort of remind people about their rights, both landlords and tenants. So it has a lot. So I'm going to give sort of a brief description. But one thing is that it is unlawful for a landlord to threaten to call ICE or to actually call ICE against a tenant. And it doesn't matter if that tenant actually has legal status and the landlord is basically just racially profiling and making assumptions about immigration status. It is not okay. It is against the law for a landlord to make that kind of threat. It's also unlawful for a landlord's attorney to make that kind of threat. And that is true whether it's sort of in response to a tenant saying, "Hey, I have some problems in my apartment. I need you to make these repairs." And then the landlord responds by saying, "Oh, I'm going to call ICE on you." No, this is completely forbidden by the law. And it's also forbidden to do that for the purpose of trying to get someone to move out. So basically, all this kind of harassment that involves threats and reporting is against the law. And this law also created a defense to eviction. So landlords, are hearing all this rhetoric from the federal government about undocumented folks and about immigrants. And we're hearing about some landlords that are sort of saying, "Hey, tenant, you already live here, but suddenly I decided I need your social security number. I need more ID." This is also against the law. And if that landlord goes forward and tries to evict someone on that basis, that person will have a defense to eviction. And there are a lot of damages. So landlords kind of thinking about ignoring this should not. A tenant can get up to 12 times the monthly rent and damages in addition to other things. And this is also violating criminal laws. So when someone goes into court about this, there will be a referral to the district attorney for criminal charges against that landlord. So landlords should really take this seriously. And I know that it is very scary right now to think about going into a court to assert your rights if you're someone who is concerned about your immigration status. But nonprofit organizations can actually use this law to go into court themselves on behalf of tenants. And in addition, someone who is a citizen, but the landlord racially profiled them and threatened to call ICE, they can also assert their rights in court. So there's a lot of avenues here. And there's a lot more to say, but I want to give time to my friends from Sage and Alexandra to talk more. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, well, but let me, before we leave that topic of that act for sure, the landlord, you mentioned some things the landlord is not supposed to do. Right now, what we have happening, of course, is you have these damned ICE agents. They don't always look like police officers of any kind. They've cowardly covered their faces and so forth and so on. Nevertheless, let's assume they show up at an apartment building or a housing complex of any kind. What is the landlord's obligation with respect to them? Does he have to let them into the building? What are his rights and duties in faced with that sort of situation in terms of vis-a-vis the rights of his tenants?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. So one thing sort of, since we know that this climate is happening and we know raids are happening, is what housing providers, landlords can do is if there's an enclosed area like a lobby or a parking lot or a courtyard, close it. Close the door. Lock the door. Put a sign outside that says residents only. Because what you want to do is establish that that is a private area that is not open to the public. And what that does is make it so that ICE is not permitted to enter without a court warrant. And they never have a court order. They're sort of waving around pieces of paper that may look official, but it's not a court order. So
Right.
what the landlord wants to do is to make those spaces private that are private and really close them down to limit the spaces that ICE then come into. And with respect to a tenant's unit, that is obviously private. So a landlord should never be in the position of saying, "Oh, let me unlock this door and go into this tenant's unit with you." Do not, that is not permitted. Again, we need to have a court order in order for there to be any legal authority for them to enter. And from what we are hearing, these people never have court orders. So, and they can be very intimidating. And we are also hearing that ICE agents are completely violating these protections. They have no court order and then they force entry anyway. If that happens, the thing to do is to ask for identification, ask questions, stay calm, record, and just say that you do not consent. It's obviously a very scary situation to be in. But the sort of first line of defense is trying to establish as much area as private as possible.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you.
Well, yes, let's get Edna and Alexandra in on the conversation. So let's say a landlord does illegally ask a tenant about their citizenship status, or say they threaten to call ICE in order to scare someone into leaving because maybe they have a rent-controlled unit that could be really more lucrative if they leave. How can tenants exercise their rights under the Immigrant Tenant Protection Act? So Edna from Sage, why don't you start? And then Alexandra, we'd love for you to chime in, or vice versa. Alexandra is unmuted already. Oh, okay. Edna.
Sure. I can definitely speak on the tenant, the LA City Tenant Anti-Harassment Ordinance. So we currently here in LA City, as a tenant, you have the right to peaceful enjoyment of your home, to not be intimidated, to not be harassed because you're a person of color, right? Due to your race, due to your gender, due to your national origin, due to your sexuality, due to your familial status, due to a disability, right? You're not even supposed to be asked about where you're born here, or, hey, it seems that you're having way too many people because of your of this nationality or ethnicity, right? Those kinds of things are considered essentially harassment under that new tenant anti-harassment ordinance that we passed, that we won. And we fought really hard for directly impacted tenants that dealt with years and years of, and years of endless landlord harassment, unlawful evictions, reduction of services, a lot of intimidation. And we got to win that. You know, we got to pass a stronger ordinance last year that went into effect on December 29th. And as of today, that ordinance is still there. And what we are doing as SAGE, along with three other community-based organizations, Inquilinos Unidos, ACE, and LA Kin, we're actually going to be informing at the city level tenants from all over LA City. LA is the largest city in the whole country. We're going to be informing tenants about this ordinance. Anywhere from the Valley to Watts, to San Pedro, to Venice, South Central, Boyle Heights, Pico Union, Mid-City, right? Westwood, every tenant in LA needs to know about this ordinance, especially now during these very critical times, because it is very scary. It is definitely very scary. And oftentimes tenants, and I speak for myself because I myself fought not one, but two evictions, feel very isolated, right? When you think you're by yourself, when you don't know who to reach out to. So we as SAGE and other organizations here, we host clinics first and third Tuesday of the month at our office in South Central. We do virtual appointments as well, hybrid, in person, and also over the phone. And we help tenants answer their questions. We help tenants file complaints, right, with the LA Housing Department, report infestations, because sometimes people think that because I'm in this situation and I may be living in an unlawful dwelling, maybe I don't have rights, or I live in a rent control unit and I don't want to jeopardize that, I'm not going to file any complaints. I'm not going to report. I'm not going to document and report the harassment, the code violations, right? The infestations, the intimidation. When landlords come into your home and they don't provide a written, per state law, per California state law, a written 24-hour notice, right? That we now strengthen through Tahoe with the exact reason why they're coming into your home. What's the reason? What's the purpose? What is the time? Right? And it has to be given to you in writing. So, yeah, we educate tenants. And more than ever, we tell tenants, don't be afraid. Make sure that you uphold your rights, that you fight for your rights. Again, regardless of your national origin, your citizenship, what you look like, you are protected. You have rights. But, you know, Tahoe and many other laws can be pretty lost, but they're just going to be pretty lost, right? If folks don't enforce them, if folks don't know about them, and folks don't enforce their rights and share this information with others, right? If you know this information, if you're out there hearing about this, share this with other folks, right? Share this information, because what we tell people, right, is that we are still undocumented for those of us that are undocumented. And I have DACA myself, right? It's temporary. It can be taken away. We are undocumented. We are directly impacted and we are unafraid. We might be a little afraid right now, and that's okay. However, knowledge is power. Knowing your rights is power. And so we got to organize and we got to hold the line from a place of power, a place of knowledge, not a place of fear, right? We got to process that fear and channel that and flush it out, right? And put that into work by sharing this information with others. So I welcome folks to, you know, use Google, reach out. Don't be afraid. Reach out. Don't think that you're by yourself and there's no help. So we're here to support and we're here to throw that with you. So thank you.
Excuse me, Edna. Mm-hmm. I wonder, SAGE is S-A-J-E. Would you, if people are listening that want to take you up on your offer of helping them and giving them advice, would you rather they called you on the phone? If so, let's give out the phone number. Would you rather they went to your website? Let the listeners know.
Anything works. We've been getting a lot of emails.
What is the phone number?
Our number is 213-745-9961. And our email is info@sage.net. And so we're answering phones. We're taking emails. We're welcoming folks in person. We have a protocol as well. Sage is a safe space. And it's also private property, meaning that, you know, if your eyes, you're not welcome.
Good.
But yeah, we want to make sure that we obviously are prepared and we stay prepared and we stay ready because as we know, everybody can be targeted, you know, but we can't let that stop us from organizing, from passing policy, from enforcing our rights and enforcing, right, the right to be, and again, to live in your home, safe, right, healthy, have an accessible home that you can afford, a home that is not making you sick either because of the code violations and the infestations.
All right. Last week, the L.A. County Board of Supervisors, Alexandra, delayed a vote on extending rent relief for tenants impacted by the fires or tenants impacted by these ICE raids and their immigration status. They delayed a vote on that. The subject of granting rent relief to immigrants has been, of course, controversial. But who is pushing for rent relief, Alexandra? And who's
can I just go back though to this tenant harassment ordinance?
Before you
just
answer,
from my perspective as an attorney who's been trying to get people to recognize that tenants are harassed. And yes, there is this law. And I don't think it's not being enforced because people don't know about it. It's because nobody is willing to enforce it. The city is not willing to enforce it. The city attorney is not willing to enforce it. There are no private attorneys taking these cases to any extent to enforce it. So I understand we are all like rah-rah enforcement, but no one's enforcing anything. And this goes back to basic discrimination for disabilities. This goes to even before undocumented issues, and this bill was passed, like there's always been a problem with enforcement, and we keep passing laws and don't stop to go, wait, are they actually being enforced? Because this law, this city anti-tenant harassment ordinance, is not enforced. And I will go even further with this law that we also have for undocumented folks to protect themselves or people perceived as undocumented. Who is going to enforce this? Because I just was doing some Google searching and it doesn't seem like any nonprofit is saying we will be the place. I am not seeing a list of private attorneys that are stepping up to say we will be the ones that will help with the private action, the right to sue, which is guaranteed, which is great. I'm glad we have that. Just like in the tenant harassment ordinance, there's a private right to sue. But who is going to do this? And I get furious because I don't know who is going to do it. And I'm sick of just being told we got a law passed, then what? And as an attorney who is the person who has to hear all of these horrible stories, just like all the organizers too, and activists who have to hear all these horrible stories and go, well, there's a law. Well, then what? So I hope that the Lawyers Guild Hour, and that's why I'm on here, lawyers step up. We need so many more lawyers. I encourage every single paralegal I work with to go become a lawyer. I am proud that another one has just gone to law school, and I'm so excited. But we need more lawyers. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish everyone could go and self-represent. It is extremely hard to do that. And we all know that because we know. and it's scary. And I would also just recommend that people look into the remote appearance issue, because I know that's coming up too, is people are not coming to court. They are not coming to court because they are afraid, and it's awful. When it comes to this Horvath, so Horvath is the only tenant on the Board of Supervisors, which is great, right? I think she's very responsive. Unfortunately, this is nothing. I just read the motion and I was like, are you freaking kidding me? And I don't know why it's taking them so long to pull their heads out of their you know what, because this is only $5,000, guys. And they can't even pass that. $5,000. How much is that going to last for a tenant in LA? That's like maybe 2 months of rent, maybe. And we know this is going to last forever. This isn't going to just go away. We know that people are so freaked out. I know that because people are not outside. I don't see people in my neighborhood. I live in mid-city. We're seeing it all over in my neighborhood that people are not going to school. They're not picking up their kids. They're scared. So yeah, step up. And I am sick and tired of us just going, oh, Trump. No, it's the people we elected in this city, in this county, who are also Democrats, who are not stepping up. And I'm disgusted by it. I am disgusted that Holly Mitchell couldn't even give a response when reporters are asking her, what's the holdup? Mm-hmm. Holly Mitchell, what's the holdup? It's $5,000 to some families that need it. And I will also say with rental assistance, just like back in COVID, it's a joke too. We all saw all the landlords get bailed out and they still went after tenants for non-payment of rent. And nobody, again, enforced all the fraud that was going on. Nobody was checking to see if the rental assistance was going to housing that was safe, that was free of mold, that had access to, I don't know, a working elevator. I mean, this is what we subsidized, was slumlords, psychopaths who then go into court. And I've seen it with my veteran clients where they're getting housing authority money. There's so much fraud, waste, and abuse. The thing that, you know, Trump says he's so all, but he don't care. And neither do a lot of these agencies, because all of them want to collaborate. And that's the problem. We pass these laws and these city council members and these county board of supervisors, they don't admit we are here actually to collaborate with the housing providers. So we are not doing more to say, no, you are here to advocate. We have more tenants in LA County than homeowners. So what is going on here? Because I'm so angry, because this is like ridiculous that $5,000, that should have just been like boom, because that's an easy band-aid, that's a little bit. But what we need, like LA Tenants Union's pushing, what I think everyone should be pushing, is an eviction moratorium. This is just like COVID all over again. And I'm like, why is this not reminding people? Like, COVID wasn't that long ago. Do we all have COVID fog so we don't remember what just happened 5 years ago? We need to stop so that we can assess. There's a lot of mutual aid that needs to be going on right now. Even at the rec center near my, at my daughter's school, they are down to one snack per kid per aftercare session. Oh, these are kids who are not getting picked up at a normal hour because their parents are afraid. So they're coming late. They're missing dinner. Hello, why is there no food for children at the parks and recs? I'm just like, wow. Like these basic things that we learned from COVID, we have to reinvent again. The food delivery, all this mutual aid stuff, just needs to be reinvented. I'm sorry, I'm like digressing from all over
the
place.
It actually segues into the next question I wanted to ask you. But I did want to also shout out a plea to lawyers to at least try to do this work, because solo private lawyers, I think they can be public interest lawyers. They don't have to be reliant on an organization. In fact, we could be more powerful with more solo attorneys out there. And there are attorney's fees provisions in those just to tempt people a little bit, and maybe someday, Alexi, your dream of seeing tenant eviction defense lawyers on billboards will be a reality. But until then, now you're going to give us the inspiration, because I know that you were inspired to see some tenants unions supporting some of the other eviction protests. That's your next question. That's your mutual aid
that I love. I love seeing that. Sorry.
Tell us about that. Tell us about the coalition work and how tenants organizations are supporting immigrants.
And I think it's really exciting to go into some other, as a housing attorney who's been so much more in the housing spaces, it's been really great to go into other spaces now, because we shouldn't be siloed, but you know, it happens. So intersections are happening. That's great. That was what we saw in COVID. I mean, I would love to see what Mike Bonin did right at COVID, which was actually bring all of us together, because that is what happened. And that was how we got a lot of these tenant protections. That's how we got protections for hotel workers, because we all work together. So we need to do that again. So It's really great, though, that the LA Tenants Union, many locals are taking on doing patrols, being there in MacArthur Park at the Home Depot. That is awesome. I'm trying to restart our local in Mid-City because it kind of got whatever, because people get busy, and COVID did really destroy a lot of organizing too. It really did. So here we are trying to come together again. And I just think of our colleagues and comrades in DC who are living in a complete fascist state, who are going, we need to go back to the basics. We need to go back to some real basic organizing. And Ed and I totally appreciate, like, we need to talk to our neighbors. That is the number one thing we all can be doing. And the best way to patrol is, you know, your neighborhood. And if we all are in a tenants union, that's another way we can help provide mutual aid to each other, make it so it's easier to patrol, because we're talking about all of LA County, which is an insane amount of land, but also just like, so everybody knows they're not alone. And that is so important right now. You're not alone. And here's so many resources, and going to stage, like, I've been to their tenant organizing meetings and where they have their clinics, and like, just having that space so that other people can hear you're not alone is so important right now. Mental health is really important right now. We can't burn out. And I'm really glad there are spaces that folks can go to and hopefully do feel safe.
It's been a while since we've had, we have this topic on periodically, but it's been a while since we have. So I want to ask the guests some more general questions, if I can. And Edna, I'm looking to you particularly for these questions. Let's assume, you know, the typical thing. Let's somebody gets a notice to quit. They get an actual eviction notice, or they get a rent due notice. Are there some key resources around town, some organizations that are on top of this sort of thing that our listeners could go to if they find themselves in that situation? Who are some of these organizations? And again, remind us, what should that person who gets that kind of notice immediately do?
Yeah, most definitely. That's a great question. And I do want to give a shout out actually to Elena Pop, Executive Director at Eviction Defense Network, because she, as a lot of y'all probably know, she's all about, we're never going to have enough attorneys, and there's no such thing as every organizer going to law school. That's just not sustainable. What we need is actually teaching these resources to those of us. I'm not even a paralegal myself. I'm an organizer, right? Teach us how to do things that is obviously not practicing, you know, legal advice or giving legal advice. But things like reading a contract, reading a notice, right? Teaching tenants on, don't be afraid, just because they're sending you a notice that looks kind of official, you should look for this, you should look for that, you should look for it saying 3-day notice to pay your quit, or 3-day notice to quit, right? Like, those, that wording is important, right? Because that could be, as eviction defense attorneys have educated us and trained us, that could actually give us a hint that that notice is invalid, right? Or it has to say 60 days, right? And then finding out how you can actually find out, right, if you have rent control or if you have some protections, right? You don't need an attorney for that. You can actually, all you need is your address. You can go to a program that Sage actually developed that is called Own It, and that is accessible to the community. We can go ahead and look up if you have rent control. If you live in LA City, you can also go to the website called ZIMAS. That's free. Again, you don't need an attorney for that, right? And you can find out if your building is really getting demolished, right, through the Ellis Act, right? And then you can also find out, right, when the property was built, because sometimes, you know, for example, and it gets really complex, right, with unlawful dwellings, meaning dwellings, you know, sheds, units that are not permitted. Sometimes, you know, tenants think, well, it's because it's unlawful, like, that means that I don't have protections. Actually, you may have protections. And so the best way to find out, right, what can you do with what you got going on is coming to a clinic. And again, Sage, we as a nonprofit, we host this clinic. There's other organizations like Inquilinos Unidos, right, like ACE, like LA Can, that also host clinics, and they partner up with volunteer attorneys, right? So with us, we partner up with Inner City Law Center. We also actually partner up with some law students that are going to law school, and they're getting mentored, right? And then also private attorneys. Yes, I agree. We need more private attorneys, you know. But unfortunately, you know, at the end of the day, people do have to get paid. And sometimes, you know, there's not attorney fees or it's just not enough, you know, for folks to get paid. And so we understand that. And so we do understand. However, we also encourage private attorneys to maybe volunteer. Maybe that's the only capacity that you have, volunteering at these clinics. And so that, and then the other thing too, that I do want to name, that sometimes you actually don't need an attorney for this, is small claims, right? You can actually take your landlord to court for up to $12,500 per claim. And that's actually something that you can do. I know that LA Law Library also has a lot of resources, and they're really, really dope. Folks have taken their time to write toolkits, guides, right? So there's a lot of free resources out there. Yes, it may or may not be accessible to people because of language barriers or technological divides. We SH have a computer lab, so you're more than welcome to come through. The law library has computers as well. Folks can come through, print out stuff. And bottom line, right, just because the landlord is telling you have to leave or you have to sign this paper or you have to let us in, that does not mean that you have to do that. Again, it's very important for people to not just because they say so, you have to do something, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's a rent increase, whether it's an addendum or an addition to your lease, or they're taking away your parking or your garage, right? Like, it's very important for you to not sign anything, right? Not let folks in, again, that you do not know, that you do not consent to having them come in. And the last thing I'll say with, you know, community safety and patrolling is just very important, right? To connect, especially with allies, because unfortunately, because of racial profiling, again, some of us might be more directly impacted. Because again, ICE, unfortunately, they are using racial profiling and going after certain people that look a certain way and that work at certain places. So nothing new. We've seen that, especially right with a lot of the folks right, resisting and Black activists, again, also because of anti-Blackness, getting racially profiled. So it's very important just for folks to be aware and be ready, especially if you are directly impacted, meaning you are not a U.S. citizen, meaning you have a green card or you have DACA like me, or you have TPS, or you don't have nothing. You get what I'm saying? Like, just be careful. Definitely protest, but definitely be smart and be ready, because we want to be protected. We want to be ready. We want to stay vigilant and we want to stay ready. We don't want to get caught up. Absolutely. However, you know, it is also our first right amendment.
We're out of time, my dear.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. Madeline Howard and Edna Munroy and Alexander Ho. Alexandria, we appreciate, first of all, I admire the work each of you are doing. We appreciate you joining us here on the Lawyers Guild show today and letting people know about that work and how people can take care of themselves. And we double down on your plea for more attorneys to listen to the call. These aren't necessarily cases that have to go up to the Supreme Court. It wouldn't kill an attorney to take a few of these cases for free, for pro bono, for God's sakes. And that's what people should be doing. We're all in this together. And this push has really come to shove in a way I haven't seen it in my lifetime recently. So everybody's got to step up to the plate. And I appreciate that plea from you, especially. You're more than stepping up to the plate. We appreciate so much what you've done. And we thank you for joining us here on the Lawyers Guild show today. We do have to now take a station identification break. But don't go away, folks, because we're going to be back with some really important news about the Supreme Court and the Voting Rights Act.
Donate your used car, truck, or boat to the KPFK Vehicle Donation Program. It's an easy way to help support KPFK and receive a tax deduction. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. An operator will arrange a good time to pick up your vehicle. 877-KPFK-AUTO or go online to kpfk.org.
And we are back with you. We are back with you after that very brief station ID break. We're happy to be back with you. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild show I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Maria Hall. And now, in what may prove to be the most consequential redistricting case to come before the Supreme Court, the High Court has asked the parties in the case of Louisiana v. Calais to tell why it should not gut the Voting Rights Act. And that's the crown jewel of the civil rights movement, my friends. The Voting Rights Act has been targeted by the right since its very enactment back in 1965. They've been whittling away at it. In 2013, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the opinion in Shelby County v. Holder, gutting Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which had required federal preclearance before changes to election rules could go into effect in jurisdictions with a history of discriminatory voting practices. And God knows there were a lot of those. And in that case, Roberts provided assurances, though, that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act should still be available to protect voting rights. Well, we know how far maybe we can carry those kind of guarantees. But on August 1st, the Supreme Court asked the parties in Calais whether compliance with Section 2 of the Act, listen to this, violates the Constitution's 14th or 15th Amendments. And by framing the question in that way, the court may be signaling its intention to eviscerate what's left of the Voting Rights Act. Well, with us today to explain and the ramifications of this case to the right to vote in the United States is Marjorie Combe. Marjorie is a professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Ms. Combe is the dean of the People's Academy of International Law, a former president, I'm proud to say, of the National Lawyers Guild. She is also a legal political analyst and writer who does commentary and writes a column on Truthout and other outlets. Marjorie Combe, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks for having me, Jim and Maria.
Well, Marjorie, let's start off by first explaining to us what this case is about and how it reached the Supreme Court.
Well, Louisiana versus Calais reached the Supreme Court after a coalition of civil rights organizations and Black voters sought to reinstate a map, a congressional map, that the state legislature had adopted in 2024. Now, that map established a second majority Black congressional district in Louisiana, and it was drawn in response to a 2022 lower federal court ruling. In that case, the district court said that a prior map, which was drawn in 2020, probably violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act because it included only one majority Black district out of the state's six congressional districts. And the coalition argued that the old map diluted the votes of Black residents, who constitute about one-third of the population of Louisiana. So the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed that district court ruling that the old map probably violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and that appellate court ordered Louisiana to adopt a new map by January 15, 2024. Well, the Louisiana legislature complied and drew a map with a second majority Black district.
Well, Marjorie, I understand that a group of self-described, quote, non-African American voters, end quote, filed a legal challenge to the 2024 map. Tell us about that.
Well, this group of so-called non-African American voters filed a federal legal challenge to the 2024 map and alleged that it constituted unconstitutional racial gerrymandering because it separated voters primarily on the basis of race. Now, a three-judge panel of the U.S. District Court agreed with them, but the Supreme Court halted the district court's ruling and allowed the 2024 map to be used in the 2024 elections while it considered the merits of the case. And this is a procedure that we've seen the Supreme Court do a lot, either agree or disagree with a lower court ruling, and then say, well, we're going to let this policy go into effect in the meantime while we consider the merits. And so that's what the Supreme Court did.
Oh, boy. Can you tell our listeners remind our listeners what the 14th and 15th Amendments say, and also what Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act says?
Yes, the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause prohibits the government from treating groups of people differently without a compelling or rational basis. The 15th Amendment forbids the government from abridging or denying the right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which was enacted to enforce the 15th Amendment, prohibits any voting qualification or prerequisite to voting or practice or procedure that results in a denial or abridgment of the right of any citizen of the United States to vote on account of race. And that happens when voters of color have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and elect representatives of their choice.
Well, on August 14th, the Fifth Circuit of the Court of Appeals handed down a ruling in the case. What was that ruling?
First of all, let me just back up. And that is in response to that petition by the non-African-American voters, so-called, in March of 2025, the Supreme Court heard arguments in the case, but in a very unusual move, they didn't make a decision. They kicked the can down the road and they said, we'll rule on the merits next term. And on June 27th, the Supreme Court issued an order saying that it would, quote, issue an order scheduling argument and specifying any additional questions to be addressed in supplemental briefing, unquote. Well, that more specific order came on August 1st, when, as Jim noted, the Supreme Court directed the parties to file briefs on the question of the constitutionality of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And the second argument in the case, the re-argument, is scheduled for October. Now, back to your question, Maria, about the Fifth Circuit. In late 2020, just for a little background, in late 2023, the district court, that's the trial court in the federal system, the district court held a 7-day trial. And at that trial, data analysis was presented and the testimony of expert witnesses and Black voters throughout Louisiana. And they testified about the discriminatory effect of the 2022 congressional map. Now, on August 14th, as you asked about, this last August 14th, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the appellate court that's above the district court, but below the Supreme Court. So the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the district court's ruling that the 2022 map violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The appeals court said that the old map diluted the voting power of Black voters because it unfairly divided communities into districts in order to reduce their voting power and thereby deny them an equal opportunity to elect candidates of their choosing. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which, by the way, is considered to be the most conservative federal appeals court in the country, rejected the assertions that the 2024 map violated the 14th or 15th Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Well, this case is a convoluted case in terms of the procedures, in terms of up and down in the various courts. When the Supreme Court takes up the case in the next term, before we get to that, has the Supreme Court not made an interim ruling?
No, they just stayed the ruling about the 2024 map, allowed it to be used in the 2024 elections, yes, and then held oral argument in March. But instead of deciding the case, they kicked the can down the road and they said to the parties, we want you to brief the issue of whether Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional. So they are going to hear the re-argument in October, and then they're going to decide on the merits by the end of June of next year.
And what will be the, remind us again, what will be the specific question that they are asking, or the questions that are being briefed and they'll be asking when they take it up in October?
Well, when they take up the merits of the case next term, the Supreme Court will, of course, review the Fifth Circuit's opinion, finding that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act was constitutional. But the question, as posed by the Supreme Court, the question before the court next term will be whether the 2024 map with the additional Black majority district will be used in 2026 and subsequent elections. Mm-hmm. And if the High Court strikes down the 2024 map, it will create a presumption that of illegal racial gerrymandering whenever drawers of maps craft majority-minority districts. In other words, districts in which people of color are the majority of voters, is effectively destroying Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
Exactly, exactly.
Wow. Well, I know you have no crystal ball, but you might be reading some tea leaves. What do you think, Marjorie Cohen, the Supreme Court is likely to do?
Well, in its August 1st order, the Supreme Court directed the reason that they came up with this idea of asking the parties whether Section 2 violated the 14th and 15th Amendment was they were relying on one of the briefs filed by these so-called non-African American voters. The Supreme Court basically identified three pages from the brief of these non-African American voters and said, we want briefing on that. We want to hear the parties brief that. And that is whether the state's intentional creation of a second majority minority congressional district violates the 14th or 15th amendments. And the voters wrote in that brief, this is the non-African American voters. Section 2 is no longer constitutional in Louisiana because the voter data from Louisiana shows that Black voters in Louisiana today have an equal opportunity to participate in the political process and elect representatives of their choice. Section 2 imposes burdens on constitutional redistricting laws that cannot be justified by Black Louisianans' needs, and Section 2 is abused to set racial quotas and elevate some groups over others, and that violates the Equal Protection Clause, that race may never be used as a negative and it may not operate as a stereotype. Well, of course, this totally ignores the fact that there was only one Black majority district out of six in Louisiana, even though Blacks constituted one third of the population. So by zeroing in on those three pages, the Supreme Court appears open to finding Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional. And as you said, Jim, Roberts wrote in the Shelby opinion in 2024 that he gutted the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which had required federal preclearance before changes to election rules could go into effect in jurisdictions that had a history of discriminatory voting practices. But in Shelby, Roberts provided assurances that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act would still be available to protect Voting Rights Act. Now, in terms of a crystal ball, they did frame the question in a very worrisome way. However, 2 years ago, the Supreme Court struck down a racist congressional district map in a 5-4 decision in a case called Allen versus Milligan. And although Kavanaugh joined Roberts in voting with the three liberals, Kavanaugh asked the Solicitor General, arguing for the administration, during the argument in March in Louisiana versus Calais, whether the Voting Rights Act requirements of race-conscious drawing of majority-minority districts can still be a constitutional remedy for voting discrimination. He said the courts long said that race-based remedial action must have a logical end point, must be limited in time, must be a temporary matter, of course, in school desegregation and university admissions. And he was referring to the Supreme Court striking down the use of race in affirmative action in university admissions. And in the Milligan case, Kavanaugh had also flagged the question of an expiration date for Section 2, but he said on a procedural ground that Alabama had not raised that issue. Now, the Voting Rights Act is one of the greatest victories of the civil rights movement. It's been targeted by the right since its enactment in 1965. Now, Roberts said in Shelby that largely because of the Voting Rights Act, voting tests were abolished, disparities in voting registration and turnout due to race were erased, and African Americans attained political office in record numbers. But as Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote in her Dissent in Shelby, and this is really key, this is Ruth Bader Ginsburg writing in 2013, throwing out preclearance, that's of, you know, in discriminatory areas, throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet. And that's the problem. Is the Supreme Court going to say we're throwing away the umbrella of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act as well? That's what's at stake here.
The consequences of that, based on history so far and the very case itself, suggest that if that happens, minority voters around the country are in for a shakedown of their rights.
Well, if you're right, Jim, because if the High Court finds Section 2 unconstitutional next term, we may well see the elimination of the 11 black majority districts, all Democratic, in Republican-controlled southern states. And that means that most of the prominent black members of Congress and the most prominent Latino members of state legislatures would no longer be able to get elected. Basically, it would eviscerate the right of everyone to vote in this country.
Wow. Wow. You know, we have a little time left, Marjorie, and if you're willing to stay with us, it's been announced that the docket starting in the next term of the Supreme Court is likely to deal with a great many cases having to do with the power of the president. Am I right about that?
You are correct.
Does that not worry you, given the way the Supreme Court seems to be going?
It does, Jim. And, you know, they are allowing racial profiling to be used to stop people that appear Latino on the streets of Los Angeles, as you well know. They say, oh, it's just temporary until we decide the merits. And in the meantime, people are being hassled and harassed and detained. And they're doing this over and over. And one of the most worrying things is that not this term, but last term, the Supreme Court decided basically that presidents are kings.
Yes.
And that presidents have immunity from prosecution for official acts, whatever that means, even though the Supreme Court said, well, we can't really define official acts. But if the president is acting in an official capacity, then he has immunity and he has absolute immunity for core official acts and presumptive immunity. That means there's a presumption that he's immune from criminal prosecution for all other official acts. And the only time that the president does not have immunity from criminal prosecution, that is from violating the law, from being prosecuted for violating the law, is when he is acting, carrying out unofficial acts. And the key, of course, is going to be what are unofficial acts. But that case, I think I wrote an argument saying the Supreme Court has affirmed that presidents are now monarchs. That case, the background of that case looming in the background, is what is going to basically guide and animate what the Supreme Court does in several of these cases next term. And as we know, in his first term, Donald Trump put three radical right wingers on the Supreme Court to create a very solid radical right wing majority of six members of the Supreme Court. And there are three liberals on the court, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. And once in a while, Roberts will go the right way and vote with the liberals because he is worried about his legacy, the legacy of the Roberts court. He doesn't want to appear too partisan, although he's not doing a very good job of not appearing partisan. And once in a while, Amy Coney Barrett will swing with Roberts and the liberals, and on rare occasions, Kavanaugh or Gorsuch. But for the most part, that voting block of six right-wingers on the Supreme Court is pretty solid. And that means, excuse my French, we're screwed.
Yeah, I was going to say there have been a number of, correct me if I'm wrong, but a number of lower federal court judges, former judges, you name it, lots of people aiming a lot of criticism at Roberts and at the court itself, the Supreme Court has always been had a political component to it. I mean, you can't take the politics out of it completely. But would you agree with those who have been critical of the court that this seems to be blatant and naked political philosophy more than legal theory?
Yes, and Jim, I think more than ever, really. I mean, there have been moments in the court's history when it's been very politicized, but I think that they've taken it to a new level with this particular court. And, you know, heaven forbid Trump has another appointment, in the next 3 years, plus years. It's very, very worrisome. And, you know, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito are the two most conservative on the conservative block. Clarence Thomas is, I believe, 77. I'm not sure Alito is getting up there. So, you know, and I don't know that they'll ever step down, but if they do, then Trump could replace them with much younger radical right wingers to basically lock in the conservative majority for decades to come. Now, we do have independent judges in the lower courts who are doing the right thing repeatedly. Supreme Court, you know, frequently does not agree with them, but they are temporarily stopping, you know, what Trump is doing. And I think it's, it's very depressing when people listen to this, but I do think that that it is important that people continue to organize and participate in First Amendment protected activity and mass movements, because that does get the attention of the court. They are not totally immune from that and inoculated from that. Yeah. And I think that we need to continue to work on every single level, the political arena, the legal arena, et cetera, to counteract this, what really is, if not already full-blown fascism, impending fascism.
Yes. Marjorie, I actually, we have only about 2.5 minutes left, but I did want to ask about that subject because you have another article out called Federal Judge Said Trump Can't Be National Police Chief. Will his word be final? Can you just give us an update on that issue since we have you on?
Yes, well, there is a law called the Posse Comitatus Act, which says that no branch of the military can be used for law enforcement, basically. And in total violation of that, Trump ordered National Guard troops and Marines, as you know, to Los Angeles, and they were enforcing the law. They weren't just standing idly by in front of federal buildings. They were actually enforcing the law. And so Judge Charles Breyer of the U.S. District Court in San Francisco, a very courageous judge, and by the way, the brother of former Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, said, no, Trump cannot do that. It violates the Posse Comitatus Act. And he said, this must stop. Now, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, well, let's issue a halt on Breyer's opinion while the merits are being heard. So now the Ninth Circuit is actually going to hear the merits of that case. And that means that the National Guard can stay there in Los Angeles, not supposed to be enforcing the law, but we know they are in the meantime. But that's combined with the Supreme Court's recent so-called temporary ruling that it's okay to racially profile people on the streets of Los Angeles that's a double whammy, and it makes things very, very difficult for people in Los Angeles.
Well, dear me, Marjorie Cohn, wonderful as always. People should follow your work, I know, on Truth Out. It's wonderful stuff. It's stuff we can understand when we see it, especially when the way you write it up is brilliant. And we thank you so much for joining us on the Lawyers Guild show today to explain some of this stuff to our audience. It's something we've got to be aware of. And as you say, we've got to keep fighting for what's left of the democracy in this country, for sure. Until next week at the same time, that's about all we have for you today, my friends, here on the Lawyers Guild show. We're glad you listened today. We thank you for that. We urge you to stay healthy. And as the song's about to tell you, we urge you to stand up for your rights, my friends.
Through October 2025, Shakespeare's. up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth.
Support comes from Wilgear Theatricum Botanicum, presenting outdoor repertory theater, events, and educational programs for all ages this June through October 2025. Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with Much Ado About Nothing, Strife, The Seagull Malibu, Wine in the Wilderness, and a world premiere, Echoes of the New World. The Theatricum is located in the heart of Topanga Canyon,